Hello, my name is Dave Emery. It's time now for the Record, and this is For the Record program number 390, titled Political Plate Tectonics. This is being recorded on December 9th of the year 2002. Before I proceed with the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you of a couple of things. There will be a detailed, annotated description of For the Record program number 390 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Also, sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, and older programs are available at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and the For the Record section of the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website as well. At this point, virtually, as I speak on December 9th of 2002, virtually the entire For the Record series is online, thanks to WFMU. And also, thanks to Spitfire, the descriptions, which are roughly article length, all of the footnoted descriptions for the Record, including programs that I've added text to, that I did not have time to get in the original program, those are in their own individual print files from For the Record 233 on up. And all of the audio material and all of the print material is free. Okay? All righty. Now, the title of the program, Political Plate Tectonics, alludes to, it's a metaphor, obviously, and there has been a lot of movement on the political scene recently. And what I'm going to be doing in this broadcast is to take a look at a number of different events that have taken place over the last week or so, and basically ask the question to what extent some of them might be related. In particular, I'm going to be taking a look at some of the Saudi money connections that obtained with regard to the inquiry into September 11th. How much of an inquiry there winds up being remains to be seen. Henry Kissinger, of course, who has a lot of connections to a lot of the powerful interests that have been implicated in one way or another with the background to September 11th. Henry Kissinger is going to be in charge of the, quote, independent, unquote, commission that's going to be, quote, investigating, unquote, September 11th. He's only got 18 months to produce the report and only roughly a $3 million budget, which isn't a whole lot. So that is something that may very well limit the scope of the investigation. Now, the title Political Plate Tectonics, again, is a metaphor. And what I'm going to be looking at is a number of things that took place last week. And again, I'm speaking on December 9th of 2002, and I'm going to be asking the question whether perhaps some of these things are directly related. In particular, as I indicated, the resignation of former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, now he's former Treasury Secretary, or his replacement has generally been attributed to the poor economic situation. I wonder whether that's in fact the case, or whether perhaps the fact that Paul O'Neill gave the go-ahead for the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids might have more to do with it. Now, we're going to talk more about those raids as the program proceeds, but of course there was a tremendous amount of economic clout. It's a tremendous amount of economic clout wielded by Saudi Arabia in the United States, not only obviously because of the fact that Saudi Arabia has a quarter of the world's proven oil reserves, but also because of the fact that they have a tremendous amount of money invested in the United States. So in addition to the direct economic influence of Saudi oil and the oil of the other Gulf states, the economic clout wielded by the investment of recycled oil dollars or petrodollars gives them a tremendous amount of clout indeed. Now, Paul O'Neill he didn't authorize it on March 20th, but in response to the documentation produced by a lawsuit that was filed by John Loftus, the very heroic former Justice Department investigator who was the author of, among other books, The Belarus Secret, and the co-author, along with Mark Ahrens, of The Secret War Against the Jews and also Unholy Trinity. John Loftus, the former Justice Department investigator, who was the one of the principal people in charge of the Office of Special Investigations and investigating the connections between Nazi war criminals brought into the intelligence system and obviously the intelligence system itself. John Loftus filed a lawsuit against Professor Sami Al-Aryan of South Florida University, and that lawsuit precipitated some documentation which, when given to the Treasury Department, was the foundation for the March 20th, 2002 raids that were conducted under the auspices of Operation Green Quest. Obviously, Paul O'Neill authorized those raids as head of the Treasury Department, and when those raids were implemented, they not only snared a bunch of individuals and institutions with direct connections to the milieu of George Bush, they also snared a bunch of individuals and institutions connected to Al-Qaeda, allegedly, and to the milieu of Al-Taqwa, which in turn goes back to the Islamo-fascist connections to the Third Reich in its above ground and underground phases. On April 4th of 2002, Talat Atman, a member of the board of directors of Harkin Energy, interceded directly with Paul O'Neill in a highly unusual proceeding. This, by the way, was discussed in For the Record Program 356 and in 376. And basically, Talat Atman, who himself has strong connections to the BCCI milieu, he was the protege of a guy named Abdullah Baksh, that's spelled B-A-K-S-H-S, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Baksh was the business representative for the Bin Laden family as a whole from 1976 through 1982, and also was the representative of Gait Faron in the Harkin Energy Consortium, and in turn, Baksh's protege, Talat Atman, was placed on the board of directors of Harkin Energy, one of George Bush's oil companies. It was Talat Atman who was a member of the audit board on the very questionable Aloha Petroleum deal that helped to benefit George Bush. It was the same sort of funky insider trading that was involved in the Enron deal. I want to stress that the foundation for this broadcast is, as is often the case, conjectural, but there was a lot of movement last week on the political landscape, and I wonder, frankly, whether the, quote, economy, unquote, was really why Paul O'Neill resigned. I have a sneaking suspicion that Paul O'Neill left at Treasury because of pressure from the Saudis, and specifically because of behind-the-scenes pressure that was pursuant to the April 4th, 2002 visit by Talat Atman to Paul O'Neill, where he basically expressed, quote, outrage, unquote. That's their way of saying, you don't do this, but he expressed outrage and expressed his great concern with Treasury Secretary O'Neill over the March 20th Green Quest raids. Those raids were tremendously important. They uncovered links between, as I've said, allegedly Al-Qaeda, the Al-Taqwa milieu, the milieu directly of George Bush and the Republican Party, and consequently, and through Al-Taqwa also to the underground Reich. So I ask, and am asking in this broadcast, whether perhaps the resignation of Paul O'Neill and the movement, because there was a lot of movement on the political landscape, is in reference to the March 20th Green Quest raids, the distress that that produced in powerful circles, Saudi circles, oil circles, Bush circles, Atman circles, and whether perhaps it was really because of the economy that Paul O'Neill resigned, or was it because when he authorized the March 20th Green Quest raids, one of the most important aspects of the entire September 11th question, and something that has been sadly ignored by an awful lot of people, I wonder whether that is the real reason why Paul O'Neill had to ditch. I suspect that's the case, but that is conjectural. Now, we're going to look at a bunch of articles that broke in the media in a very short period of time. That's why this broadcast is titled Political Plate Tectonics. The first of the articles comes from the Financial Times of December 4th of 2002. This is an article by Edward Alden, last name A-L-D-E-N, in Washington. Its headline, Saudis Resist U.S. Push on Terror Funds. Now, this article is at fundamental variance with most of the articles that the coverage of this story that was presented in the American press. The American press mainly carried the assertion by Abdel al-Jubeir, the foreign policy advisor to Crown Prince Abdullah, that the Saudis were, in fact, being very vigorous in their pursuit of the September 11th investigative links, and that they were being very rigorous in their crackdown on the financing of Islamo-fascist groups. That was concurred with by American officials in their at least official statements, but in fact, as we're going to see from the Financial Times, obviously a British paper, the reality is considerably different. In fact, Abdul al-Jubeir told the U.S. and the investigative authorities basically to do something to themselves, and I don't mean investigate themselves. Again, this is from the Financial Times of December 4th of 2002. That was a Wednesday. The article reads, Saudi Arabia said yesterday it would not lower its standard of evidence for designating financial supporters of terrorism, setting the stage for continued tension with the U.S. over the adequacy of Saudi measures to crack down on the financing of terrorism. Again, we were not told that basically Saudi Arabia said, nope, it's not going to lower its standard of evidence. Continuing, but Adel al-Jubeir, foreign policy advisor to Crown Prince Abdullah, the Saudi leader, said he did not believe that the U.S. would act unilaterally against Saudi individuals or groups suspected of supporting terrorism. Quote, when it comes to designations of either individuals or organizations, we work together, unquote, he said. The administration of President George W. Bush is debating whether to step up pressure on the Saudis by threatening on its own to designate and freeze bank accounts of some Saudis suspected of financing terrorism. Since last March, the two governments have agreed that all such actions would be undertaken jointly. Some officials want the U.S. to act alone if the Saudis fail to cooperate after the U.S. presents additional evidence regarding suspect individuals and groups. But others believe that maintaining voluntary cooperation from the Saudis is the only way to move forward. Again, we weren't told about this aspect of this consideration, namely that basically the Saudis told us to bugger off, as they say. It's not something that they wanted done. I would also note that the following days, actually 2 days later, the Financial Times of December 6th of 2002 contained the following article by Hugh Williamson in Berlin, and this concerns an investigative link between a trial of an Al-Qaeda suspect in Hamburg that has produced some evidentiary tributaries leading in the direction of, surprise, surprise, Saudi Arabia. And this article is headlined, again, from the Financial Times of December 6th of 2002, obviously referring to news that had broken the previous week. Remember, the previous article was from December 4th. This article reads, German prosecutors are investigating possible links between the alleged Al-Qaeda terrorist on trial in Hamburg and diplomats and Islamic activists from Saudi Arabia. The business card of a member of staff at the Saudi embassy in Berlin was found among the possessions of Munir al-Motasadek, the Moroccan student charged with having helped plan the September 11th attacks when he was arrested last year, a spokeswoman for the chief federal prosecutor said yesterday. Mr. Motasadek is also thought to have made telephone calls to Saudi Arabia dating back to December 2000, according to German media reports. Notebooks and computer files seized from Mr. Motasadek's Hamburg flat contain many Saudi Arabian telephone numbers. Telephone records indicate he called the numbers many times. Mr. Motasadek has admitted knowing the Hamburg hijackers involved on September 11th, but denies involvement in the attacks. The possible Hamburg Al-Qaeda cell connection with Saudi Arabia comes as investigations continue in the U.S. into links between the September 11th hijackers and the Saudi Arabian embassy in Washington. Bear in mind that on September 12th, a plane chartered by Prince Bandar, then the Saudi ambassador to the United States, flew 12 members of the Bin Laden family out of the United States on September 12th. The bin Laden family were the only civilians who could fly in the United States on September 12th, courtesy of Prince Bandar. Continuing. Separately, relatives of September 11th victims who were co-plaintiffs in the Hamburg trial intend to use evidence from the court case in a civil lawsuit in the U.S. against the Saudi Arabian royal family, a lawyer for the co-plaintiffs said yesterday. The civil suit, filed in August, accuses three senior Saudi Arabian princes, Sudan's government, and several Middle Eastern banks of funding al-Qaeda. That again on December 6th. Note again that there appear to be links between this alleged al-Qaeda operative and, again, a member of the Hamburg cell that appears to have been central to the attacks, and the Saudi embassy in Berlin. Note also that the plaintiffs in this trillion-dollar lawsuit are planning on using the information in this trial in connection with the lawsuit. As we looked at in For the Record 389, among the new defendants in that lawsuit is the Al-Taqwa Bank. And I would also note that Yassin Al-Qadi, also one of the many people in the many of the defendants in this lawsuit, is also connected to Al-Taqwa and to the Operation Green Quest raids on March 20th. Another article about Saudi links to this accused hijacker on trial in Hamburg. This from the San Francisco Chronicle on Sunday, December 8th of 2002. This is a New York Times story by Desmond Butler. It's headlined, German officials probing September 11 suspects say U.S. and Saudis less than cooperative. Subtitled, requests for help went unanswered. They complained at state-lined Berlin, and it reads in part as follows. Now, bear in mind that on Friday, December 6th, Paul O'Neill announced his resignation along with Lawrence Lindsay as Secretary of the Treasury. First article we looked at was from Wednesday, December 4th. Then we have an article from Friday, December 6th, both of those from the Financial Times of London. This article, a New York Times story on Sunday, December 8th. The previous day's papers covered the resignation of Paul O'Neill, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. But again, note the timing here. Note that basically the foreign policy advisor to Crown Prince Abdullah tells us to go hide with regard to lowering the evidentiary standards. And it's sort of ironic that the weapons inspectors in Iraq were being held at bay, at least in terms of a diplomatic sense, over the issue of whether or not the investigations could actually go into Saddam's his palace, his residence. I don't know, not officially a palace. But the investigation into September 11th, sure as bloody hell, is going into the royal palace in Saudi Arabia. But it would appear that the door is not only being held closed by the Saudis, but that Crown Prince George Walker bin Abdul Aziz, the administrator of the Saudi States of America, the colonial magistrate of the Saudi States of America, is helping to keep that door closed. Again, Chronicle of Sunday, December 8th. This article from the New York Times, Dateline Berlin, reads in part, German authorities investigating a Moroccan man on trial on charges that he was involved in the September 11th attack say there is evidence that he had contact with a Saudi diplomat as well as the leaders of an extremist group in Saudi Arabia. But German officials said that despite their requests for help following up on these leads, responses had not been forthcoming from either American or Saudi authorities. In Washington, a Justice Department spokesman who declined to be named called questions about the German authorities' requests, quote, too sensitive, unquote, for comment. After the arrest of the Moroccan Munir al-Motasadegh in Hamburg last year, the police found the business card of an official in the Saudi embassy in Berlin in his apartment. Prosecutors say they also found records of numerous calls to Saudi Arabia, which have since been traced to members of an extremist group in Riyadh called Dar al-Asima al-Nar, and I may be mispronouncing that. Cell phone numbers of the group's leaders were found saved on Motesadek's computer. And again, notice the other things that were happening in this very same week. And For the Record, program number 358, we noted that the We also took note of this to a certain extent in For the Record 357. We noted that there is a very strong connection between the Muslim Brotherhood and some of the most extreme elements of the world Muslim community, those elements that I have designated as Islamo-fascist, and I want to be very careful not to be misunderstood, as always, by as characterizing Islam as fascist, but there's a very powerful element within it that is grouped around the Wahhabi sect and the Muslim Brotherhood. It is in turn inextricably linked with the history of fascism and the history of the Third Reich and its above ground and underground phases, as we've looked at in many broadcasts. And by way of assessing the political plate tectonics that were underway in this past week, I want you to take note of what else happened this very, very same week. This is from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, December 6th, in turn chronicling things that took place on Thursday, December 5th. This took place the day before O'Neill resigned. This is an article by Dana Milbank from the Washington Post. It was carried in the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, December 6th. It's datelined Washington, and it's headlined, Bush reaffirms Islam's place in U.S. society despite critics. President Bush on Thursday pushed ahead with his administration's efforts to portray Islam in a favorable light. Returning to the Islamic Center of Washington for a second visit to the mosque, he toured in the days after the September 11th attacks. Bush's speech at the Islamic Center was the 17th time since the terrorist attacks that the president had devoted a speech or a passage of a major speech to proclaiming the peaceful and humanitarian values of Islam. It was in a visit to the Islamic Center that George Bush was rubbing elbows with associates of the Islamic Institute. That is an organization set up by key GOP operative Grover Norquist. It, in turn, overlaps not only the milieu of al-Qaeda, the milieu of al-Taqwa. It overlaps the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids on March 20th. And it overlaps specifically the ethnic outreach organization of the GOP. That is an organization that in the past has been a repository for Third Reich and Central and Eastern European fascist elements, many of them war criminals of the First Order. We've spoken about that in numerous broadcasts. Interestingly enough, that in turn, the incorporation of those Central and Eastern European fascist elements into the Republican Party as a major element of its ethnic outreach or institution, that was an outgrowth of the Crusade for Freedom that was the godchild of Bush associate Alan Dulles. It was administered by Dulles' protege Richard Nixon, fronted for by Ronald Reagan, and the State Department machinations to bring these people in the United States were supervised by William Casey. It later, that is to say, the ethnic outreach organization, which had coalesced only in presidential election years, it was formally incorporated as a permanent and critical element of the Republican Party when the elder George Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee in 1973. The Islamic Institute and many of the Islamo-fascist elements targeted in the Green Quest raids overlap the GOP's ethnic outreach organization. And one of the things that I noted in For the Record 358, and this is something that has been criticized very vigorously by more enlightened and, shall we say, circumspect Muslim spokespersons, and that is the fact that many of the organizations, including and especially the Council on American-Islamic Relations, that have been allowed to assume the position in the United States as basically de facto spokespersons for the entire Muslim world, more than a sixth of the world's population, are basically Wahhabite. They are Islamo-fascist in nature, and one of the people here who is quoted about George Bush's visit is Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He refused to condemn Osama bin Laden, and a past director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations blamed September 11th on the Mossad and the First World Trade Center attacks on the Mossad. Another former director is actually a suspect in the First World Trade Center attack in 1993. That attack linked to the milieu of September 11th. I would also note that a former member of the board of directors of the Islamic Institute was Talat Atman, the former director of Harkin Energy, who interceded with the former, now former, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. Skipping down in this story, American Muslim groups have urged Bush to speak out more forcefully against conservatives who have maligned Islam as an enemy of the United States. Even these groups, however, have been surprised by the number of opportunities Bush has taken to deliver his Islam is peace message. As Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American Relations described it recently, "Even I get a little tired of that," unquote, Hooper said. Well, Hooper and his ilk represent the very worst of Islam, and it is more than a little interesting to see George Bush basically kissing a blank blank yet again. That on Thursday, December 5th, the day before Paul O'Neill resigned. And there was other movement, and this again is why I'm talking about political plate tectonics. This is quite interesting as well. This is from the New York Times of that very same day. This is Friday, December 6th of 2002. And while Crown Prince George Walker bin Abdul Aziz, the colonial magistrate of the Saudi States of America, was kissing a blank blank at the Islamic Center in Washington, D.C., some PR people who were working for the Saudis were bailing. And this happened the day before Paul O'Neill was basically ousted as Treasury Secretary, and I'm wondering whether the economy is really why that happened. New York Times, Friday, December 6th of 2002, story by Philip Sheenan, Dateline, Washington. Three partners quit firm handling Saudi's PR. Saudi Arabia's latest public relations problem may be with its public relations firm. Three of the founding partners of the Washington firm Corvis Communications, that's Q-O-R-V-I-S, have announced that they are leaving, and associates say their departure reflects a deep discomfort in representing the government of Saudi Arabia against accusations that Saudi leaders had turned a blind eye to terrorism. The firm, hired by the Saudi government in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, has been paid about $200,000 a month to help the Saudis bolster their battered image with the American public. The most prominent of the departing executives is Judy Smith, a former White House deputy press secretary who became the spokesman for Monica Lewinsky during President Clinton's impeachment. Later, a spokeswoman for the family of Chandra Levy, the murdered Washington intern. Very interesting couple of people for her to have as clients. Continuing, she and other departing partners, Bernie Merritt and Jim Weber, two longtime Republican Party strategists announced on Wednesday that they were leaving Corvus to join a New York-based consulting and public relations firm, Clark & Weinstock. Spokesmen for the Saudi embassy and Corvus did not return phone calls for comment. Skipping down. But friends and associates, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the departures had been prompted largely by growing evidence of ties between prominent Saudis and the financing of the terrorism network of Al-Qaeda, and by a concern that the firm and its reputation were being overwhelmed by its work for Riyadh. And if anybody wants any further proof of why that might have been a very good time to bail, and again, that was the same day that Bush was kissing a blank blank at the Islamic Center in Washington, the San Francisco Chronicle of that same day, Friday, December 6th of 2002, contains the following. This is an AP story by Ala Shaheen. This is titled, "Saudi's Top Cop Says Jews Behind September 11th. The Saudi police minister has claimed Jews were behind the September 11th attacks because they have benefited from subsequent criticism of Islam and Arabs, according to media reports. Interior Minister Prince Nayef made the remarks in the Arabic-language Kuwaiti daily Asaya last month. The latest edition of Ayn al-Yaqeen, a weekly internet magazine devoted to Saudi issues, posted the Asaya interview in its own English translation. Quote, "We know that the Jews have manipulated the September 11th incidents and turned American public opinion against Arabs and Muslims," Prince Nayef was quoted as saying in the Arabic text, while Ayn al-Yaqeen's English version referred to Zionists instead of Jews. "We still ask ourselves, who has benefited from the September 11th attacks? I think they, the Jews, were the protagonists of such attacks," Nayef was quoted as saying. And again, that sort of speaks for itself. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record program number 390 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available at a longer URL. Link to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 390, Political Plate Tectonics. It is being recorded on December 9th of 2002. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.